You had plenty of money, 1922.
Hi, and welcome to the Movie You Love podcast, the podcast where, as usual, I keep saying every other week I sit down and talk with another guest, but really, it's every other month, or every other week, or every other day, or every other 3 weeks, or like whenever I feel like it, and I'm not quite sure. Like, guys, I'm working on it. I have a couple in the back end, which I'm going to be pushing out in the next few weeks. But here's the first of, I hope, many to come on schedule posted podcasts. This week, Josh Spiegel, the host of Mousterpiece Cinema, which is hosted over at MovieMezzanine.com, sits down to talk with me about Who Framed Roger Rabbit, the amazing live-action animated hybrid. And he talks about his Disney love, and there's a lot going on here. And I know you guys are listening to this, and you're like, where's the weird intro where Andrew talks for 20 minutes about something going on in his life? I don't think I'm doing that today, guys. I don't really have much on my mind. I haven't had much happen with my life. I mean, everything's kind of status quo. It's internet, sleep, movie, work, don't really do much. I guess I could talk about the fact that I did that whole U.S. Embassy thing a few weeks back. I was tweeting about, I went to the U.S. Embassy for the first time in 15 years to get a visa, and it is dramatically different. Like, I have never before in my life felt as herded as I did going to beg the Americans for a visa so I could go to their country, which I am planning to do in a few more weeks, to go up for a weekend. Nothing film related, nothing special. I'm going for a friend's wedding. And hopefully it'll be wonderful. I'll be up in Nebraska. Like, I never knew I'd ever say that sentence. I'll be in Nebraska for a couple days. I'm going to go see a friend of mine get married and applaud her and quietly sit there and go, not me yet. Not that I'm saying I want to be married, but, you know, like, I see all my friends getting married and I'm like, are you guys running? Are we doing a race? Like, when did this happen? Like, aren't we supposed to be married in our 30s? Or maybe that's just because I'm a dude. Is that because I'm a guy? I guess I have guy friends who are already married. And I go, you got lucky. Anyways, why am I talking about this? We're talking about animation. We're talking about Disney. We're talking about Josh Spiegel. Everybody should go and listen to his podcast. As I said, it's over at Movie Mezzanine. Go on iTunes and go and check it out. It is Mousterpiece Cinema. But more to the fact, if you're subscribing to this podcast, thank you. Go on iTunes and rate and review the podcast. It would be a big help. I really enjoy reading those and seeing those up there. And now, for the first time in a long time, I have a Windows computer. So I can actually look at iTunes and look at reviews and see what's going on there. So go and make me happy, because it makes me happy to see them. Go and rate and review the show, and thank you so much for listening. And thank you to my guest. So here's a conversation.
Because if he doesn't, he's going back to the science lab.
What's wrong with that tank?
Nothing with you, baby Herman. You were great. You were perfect. You were better than perfect. This Roger, he keeps blowing his lines.
Roger.
What's this?
A tweeting bird.
Tweeting bird. Roger, read the script. Look what it says. It says rabbit gets clunked.
Rabbit sees stars. Not birds.
Stars! Can we lose the playback, please? You're killing me, killing me.
They're crying out.
So, Mr. Josh Spiegel, can I say that I'm kind of happy that this is the movie you've selected, because I know you as the Disney guy on Twitter. Because, I mean, there's a certain quaintness to Disney as a property, and I'm not talking about the now teenage version of Disney where we're talking about them owning Marvel and them owning all these other properties. I'm talking about straight, pure form Disney animation and Disney products. That I've gotten to that age where it becomes less and less likely that I'll have conversations about those things.
Well, it's much more fun talking about Lucasfilm and Star Wars and all the new Marvel superhero movies, right? Yeah, there's not that much also out there anymore. They don't make a lot of these kinds of movies anymore, which makes me sad. But
so you decided that for your film to talk about on this show, you wanted to talk about the 1988 Robert Zemeckis film Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And I'm going to just ask, as it's always where I start talking about the first time you actually saw this film, was it a theatrical release for you?
It was. It is the first movie I remember seeing in theaters, actually.
Wow.
My parents have told me, my parents have told me that they brought me to see a re-release of Cinderella in 1987 when I was three. But my first memory of any movie ever is of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, specifically of me being scared out of my mind at the end of the film when Judge Doom reveals that he's not really a judge and that he's a psychotic toon and B, the psychotic toon who killed Eddie Valiant's brother. And that terrified me. So it was a very indelible image in my brain.
That is actually one of the few things I noted rewatching this movie, because this is a movie that I saw as a child and I remember loving it. My parents took me to the drive-in to watch this movie, and they always tell me these stories about, yeah, we took you to that movie, but there are very few that I actually remember being in the drive-in with them. I mean, I remember things like Batman, and I remember the Flintstones, but I don't really remember. I don't really remember Roger Rabbit. I remember watching it repeatedly as a child on television. And rewatching it today, I remember noticing that when you're talking about a film about cartoons and in Toontown, in a world where violence really is a part of comedy, and there is no consequence to it. When you get to that end moment when you see Christopher Lloyd as a judge being flattened by the steamroller, and we discover he's a toon, like, that's the first real piece of violence that's on screen that isn't played off straight for comedy. And then we see, like, 2 minutes later, him being killed the toon way through the dip.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's probably one of the most horrifying things in that movie.
Yes, easily. I think that, I mean, especially now you watch, I mean, technically, it's not actually a Walt Disney Pictures film, as I'm sure you noticed when you watched it today. It's actually from Touchstone, but obviously we associate it with Disney because you have characters like Mickey Mouse and Bugs.
Dumbo was in there.
Not Disney, but you got Donald Duck. You've got all sorts of other Disney characters, all the way down to like Clarabelle Cow has like a walk-on kind of in the background at one point. And yet the violence,
and
even
Mickey
the violence
Mouse is in there.
Sure. The Mickey Mouse scene where he and Bugs Bunny give Eddie Valiant their own very special kind of spare parachute. You know, there's all sorts of gags like that that even now seem a little darker just because Disney animation in the 30s and 40s, I don't think was nearly as associated with violence like in Looney Tunes stuff with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck or, you know, Yosemite Sam. It wasn't as violent. There was more of a lightness to it. So seeing those characters, seeing Donald Duck pull out a cannon to shoot Daffy Duck into another piano is kind of disturbing because I don't think of those characters as being that prone to madness almost.
And the weird thing about it is, and I know this is part of me spending so much time thinking about movies, and more to the point, recently, like within the last few years, starting to understand movies as a business and start to kind of play around with understanding why certain things happen in movies as opposed to they don't, or certain things don't happen as opposed to they do. I spent a lot of time watching this movie kind of paying attention to all of the cameo characters that appeared and asking myself how much effort or how little effort it would have been in the 80s for someone like Zemeckis and Touchstone to figure out all the financials so that they could have all of these characters from Disney, all of these characters from Hanna-Barbera, all of these characters from Looney Tunes all appear in the same world on screen for us.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think I've read before that, you know, the example with the Mickey Mouse Bugs Bunny scene, I think that there was some kind of stipulation that each character had to have the same number of lines. Mickey couldn't say more than Bugs, and Bugs couldn't say more than Mickey, for example. And I think I am pretty sure that Steven Spielberg, who produced the film, was very instrumental in bringing specifically Disney and Warner Brothers together in terms of just allowing the usage of these characters, if not to speak, to just be in the background, to be present. Because otherwise, I mean, that world would have felt so thinly drawn, not intended, but that world would not have felt as rich because it would have just been Disney characters or maybe Disney and some Hanna-Barbera characters. But having that diversity of all these characters who we've all grown up with for decades, I think that, you know, it's a good thing that they were able to cut their way through the red tape and figured out how to get all these characters on the same page in a way.
I actually now want to watch the movie again tonight to kind of pay attention and see if anyone kind of got more favor in any scenes now that you mentioned that stipulation.
I mean, it's possible, but I feel like they did. I mean, especially with the bigger characters, I don't think anybody really was fighting that hard for Droopy to have a certain number of lines when he was playing an elevator doorman.
But. Yeah, definitely. So, walk me through this. You say this is the first movie you can remember seeing in the theater. I'm assuming at this point in time, you at that age would have been very familiar with the idea of cartoons and probably had a few favorite characters of your own. How was it for you to watch a film like this where, for the most part, the movie is spending a lot of time breaking the guise of what cartoons are, which is that they are silly entertainment for children, but they kind of, at the moment that they call cut, even in that initial scene, when sure. They're filming the Roger Rabbit and I can't remember the baby character. Baby Herman skit. The moment the filmmaker shouts cut, you kind of see the baby become pretty much an adult going, being sexist and shouting curse words and doing all sorts of crazy things.
I don't know that I fully appreciated it. Certainly not what I was, because I was, I would have been 3 going on 4 when I saw this in theaters because it came out in June of 1988. And I watched it a ton when I was younger as well. I would watch it anytime it was on TV. I don't know if I ever actually owned it on VHS, but I watched it as much as I could. And I doubt that I fully grasped the fourth wall breaking elements when I was a little kid. Although a number of the comedies I watched when I was a little kid, older comedies that I watched that my parents let me watch, were similarly fourth wall breaking. I remember watching Airplane a lot as a kid, and that definitely has its way with skewering conventions of the genre of disaster movies and Young Frankenstein, a lot of Mel Brooks movies, a lot of Marx Brothers movies. So I maybe didn't feel like it was a very unique film in that specific respect only because I was watching those kinds of movies a lot, movies that had fun with the concept of making a movie of what it meant to tell these kinds of stories with your tongue firmly planted in cheek.
It's special when I'm watching a film like this, that it's one of those movies that I feel are meant for adult audiences. I'm kind of curious, like, as time went by with you and this film, like, how is it that your perception of the film changed over time? Because, I mean, there's so many adult thoughts within this movie. There's, number one, the general L.A. private investigator story, which is kind of trite, but at the same time, it plays with a lot of stuff. And more importantly, there's so many themes of stuff like alcoholism and jealousy and stuff which children aren't going to grasp on, but are still going to be watching this movie anyways. How did you change your perception of it over time?
I mean, I don't know if I specifically changed the perception, but it was one of those cases where certain lines stuck with me because I liked the cadence or the delivery, and then one day I realized, oh, that's what that means. You know, a line like when Eddie Valiant and Roger Rabbit are conferring as they're trying to figure out what's going on, and Roger says he confuses prostate and probate, and then Eddie shouts at him, and I was a kid, I just thought that was funny because Bob Hoskins was funny in the movie, and then I realized, oh, that's what a prostate is. Okay, I wouldn't have known that when I was 4 or 5, and there's a lot of different elements like that that I think allow the movie to improve on repeat viewings. You know, the very noir elements of Eddie's story, as well as the almost Chinatown-esque riff on public transportation almost becoming a scourge in L.A., vanishing in L.A., and then the onslaught of the freeway, this domineering force of technology and commerce. I didn't appreciate that when I was a little kid. It was through watching it when I was older. It was probably through reading the work of critics like Ebert, who would go back and review these films for, you know, he did for his great movies list. And that kind of criticism, I think, allowed me to kind of appreciate the broader elements at play that I definitely did not appreciate when I was a kid. I honestly don't know that my parents probably were very happy to have let me see this when I was 3 or 4, because I'm sure a lot of the humor went right over my head. Obviously, I liked stuff like Baby Herman and Roger Rabbit going crazy in that opening scene, but all the dialogue probably went right over my head at first.
Did this movie frighten you at all as a child?
Well, sure. Like I said, that opening scene, that ending scene, rather, it terrified me. I mean, it didn't terrify me enough to like stop watching movies, but it definitely scared me.
There are a few key points that this movie kind of focuses on, especially when it comes to the dialogue, because movies, they tend to do this. Like, sometimes they can't quite hit a note properly visually or thematically, and they'll just kind of shoehorn it in as like a line for us to focus on. And there are two lines specifically that somehow kind of jumped out at me in this movie. And one is with Jessica Rabbit. And it's a famous line that people all kind of pay attention to in this movie, where she kind of says that, I'm not bad, I'm just drawn that way.
Sure.
And being a movie which kind of deals with this voluptuous woman, especially I like the idea that when she's introduced, she kind of handed off from Betty Boop.
Yes.
Betty Boop is there, and she just kind of goes, oh, look at that one over there. And, yep. You know, it's kind of a nice nod.
Sure.
I'm kind of curious, talking as someone who talks about animation most of the time, and especially talking about, I don't know if you get much into outside of the Disney world of animation, talking about Japanese animation or even comic books as art is done, because people always have those conversations about quote unquote sex position in animation, where women are bent and taught and kind of twisted into the images of male fantasy.
Sure.
Seeing a character like Jessica Rabbit, is there something that you feel is more intent than just being the visual candy of this film?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I admit I'm not terribly familiar with the Japanese style. I mean, I'm aware of anime, and we've talked about Miyazaki's films on the podcast before, but outside of that, I admit my knowledge is fairly surface level, so I don't want to presume too much there. I admit my ignorance. But in general, I mean, I feel like it's just that character, I think, is just a really solid riff on the femme fatale, on the Lauren Bacall or the Barbara Stanwyck and Double Indemnity kind of role from the 40s and 50s. And I think, you know, they not only visually do they do an excellent job of presenting Jessica Rabbit, both upending Eddie's presumptions, because he of course assumes that Roger Rabbit would be married to a rabbit, which is obviously not true. And I think that they do a great job of casting, because even though I believe she's uncredited, I mean, Kathleen Turner has just had that great smoky noirish voice, and she'd used it to great effect in Body Heat a few years earlier in both her voice and how she looked in that film. But I think it's just a really solid riff on the femme fatale. And even if that line that you cited, the I'm not bad, I'm just drawn that way, even if that's a little on the nose in terms of spelling out that character, I mean, it's still one of the great lines in modern cinema. It's just such a perfect encapsulation of a character.
Holy shit, I never realized it was Kathleen Turner.
It is, yeah.
because And I admit this weirdness that I kind of associate with Kathleen Turner. I view Kathleen Turner in two different people. There's 80s Kathleen Turner, which is Romancing the Stone to me.
Sure.
And then there is modern Kathleen Turner, who appeared in like the third season of Californication and sounds like one of those people who smoked too much and ruined their voice completely. And it's just so weird to me.
You can hear the smoking. You can hear the smoker's voice a little bit in her early work, and I admit her current state. I think of her on Friends, playing the drag queen version of Chandler Bing's mother, which father rather, not mother. But either way, yeah, she's definitely had a very interesting career. But I think this is one of her best roles, and it just requires her voice. But it's such an amazing voice that's so perfect for that character.
So this movie, I don't think I want to go ahead and put something as as definitive as to say it was, but it definitely it was the first. But I think it was definitely one of the first films, at least big films, to kind of do an animation live action hybrid. As I've mentioned many times, as being a person who talks about animation so much, where does that as a medium kind of fall for you in your enjoyment of entertainment? Do you kind of view it as something where you're like, it's interesting they did this with animation, or do you kind of view it as it's interesting they did that with live action?
I mean, I think in this case, it's amazing that they were able to actually pull off as much as they were able to do. There are some really fascinating special features that I think were on the DVD that have been brought over to the Blu-ray edition that show you exactly how incredibly detailed they had to be in terms of choreographing each scene, each shot, the way that Bob Hoskins would have to pretend to be, you know, the scene where Roger holes up in Eddie's office and he tries to throw him out and then he shoves him into the sink in his kitchen, and the amount of work that every actor had to do, that the, you know, just in terms of where they placed the camera. I think in this case specifically, it's just fascinating how much work had to be accomplished. The one thing I want to clarify, though, this is Disney had been doing hybrid live action animation in some respect for about 45 years, on and off, not like every year or something, but obviously the most famous example is probably Mary Poppins, which has that long scene in the middle where the Mary and Bert, played by Dick Van Dyke, and the kids go into the painting and they're interacting with this animated world. And then there are cases like Song of the South or The Three Caballeros. And then I think Bedknobs and Broomsticks was also another example of that. But I think this is probably the first time, in terms of it being very unique, that the entire movie is just this mix. Whereas, you know, other, I think a lot of those films, there's one or two scenes. But this was a case where, you know, the timing was just right. Hand-drawn animation was just about to come back in vogue for Disney. They were a year away from The Little Mermaid. I think this was just an excellent mix of those two media to just create something that still, I think, holds up really well. I don't know if you would agree, having just seen it again today, but I think there's a fairly seamless element in terms of where the live action ends and the animation begins in each shot.
So I actually can't remember watching this movie in the last 15 years. I mean, I remember seeing bits on television, and there's a scene specifically which I'll talk about, which I kind of fell in love with seeing bits on television, and I still think it's my favorite scene in this movie, having rewatched it last night. But I really don't know much about the production side of this movie, the stories of the production. But oddly enough, watching this today, I kind of imagined that it would have been done similarly to how, for example, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes was being done today, with a little less of the technology know-how, where literally they're wireframing over actors, just with hand-drawn animation on frames, as opposed to the actual... Sorry?
No, go ahead.
Oh, I thought you were just cutting out there for a second. Nope. And as opposed to in the Apes movies or in any of the last decade of CG Andy Serkis movies, where they're literally having him in a suit and kind of taking his motions and kind of mapping wireframe designs to his motions. And that's kind of how I imagine I would have done it then, but that's me as a problem solver. Am I near?
I mean, that's partly it. It's funny because the guy who voiced Roger Rabbit, Charles Fleischer, who, you know, he's a comedian, and I think probably his most memorable on-screen role to a lot of people was in another Robert Zemeckis film. He's got a bit role in Back to the Future Part 2, and he actually dressed up as Roger Rabbit and basically inserted him, like they used him as a model of sorts sometimes, not often, I think, during the actual filming of scenes, but in terms of preparing, in terms of rehearsing, like he'd get into this costume and it's on one of those features and it is super creepy because I mean, this guy is like mid-40s dressed like Roger Rabbit and it's just disturbing.
I think that should be the movie. We should release that movie in theaters today and just fill the theater with children and see what happens.
I think that the appeal of Who Framed Roger Rabbit vanishes overnight. That's my guess. I mean, it is, but I mean, a lot of it is what you're talking about in terms of how they we're performing each scene, the amount of wire work is really extensive. And it's not surprising. Again, a lot of the stuff with him having to, like, there's a lot of robotics I think they also used in, you know, that they would eventually animate over. And it's just, it's stunning. And I think it's especially stunning when you consider how good the human performances are. It's not just that they're acting opposite, you know, like, it's different when you're an actor who's working in a special effects heavy movie, maybe not like Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, but something like, I don't know, Star Trek or something, where you have to pretend that there's something there and there's nothing there. And there's just you and a green screen. I mean, this is Bob Hoskins and all these other actors on a real set that looks like they really built it. You know, it looks like a real place, and he's having conversations with no one. And somehow he's able to deliver this really complex and emotional and just really three-dimensional performance. And it's all the more impossible when you consider what he had to do to actually pull that off.
I actually remember hearing recently from, I think it was Peter Jackson who talked about this, talking about CG heavy films and actors, realizing that theater actors always bring out the best performances in these kinds of movies, where you're going to put them on a set with a big blue screen and they have to pretend that someone else is there. Because when you're on the stage, and I guess this is something that I never quite thought about at the time, because I don't see that much theater myself. And I blame my geography for that. And I guess I always found it kind of weird to kind of pick up a taping of a theater production. And I feel I should try, but I haven't gotten there yet. But I like his explanation, where when they are on the stage, there's only so much they can construct for you set-wise. You just have to give the rest and kind of make the performance, make the audience see the stage that you want them to see. When you're doing these CG heavy films, it's pretty much the same thing, and they just add in all of the set for you and all of these other characters and stuff. But when you're talking about through and through film actors, where everything had to be built so that it could be caught in the camera, those guys kind of get lost in that process. And I guess Bob Hoskins would probably be one of the best to do this kind of a role at that point, because for the most part, British actors always come through the theater.
Well, yeah, and I mean, and he had proven himself just in terms of being the right kind of tough guy. And I even think physically, he's just so good to play essentially a Sam Spade kind of a character. He's maybe not as glamorous as Humphrey Bogart was, but he has the kind of hard-bitten private detective who looks like somebody you wouldn't want to walk next to in a darkened alley. And in terms of his ability to just interact, it is a lot of... it is a lot on him. You know, a lot of it has to be on his ability to convince not just the audience that he's interacting with Roger Rabbit, but he has to convince himself. And I think that's the biggest challenge, I assume. I admit I'm not an actor, so I can't presume that that's the case, but I feel like that must have been one of the more difficult parts. It's not just I have to convince the camera that I'm interacting with Roger or these weasels or anybody else. I really have to believe it myself. You know, if he doesn't believe that he's talking to Betty Boop in that scene at the Ink and Paint Club, then it's easy for the audience to doubt it as well.
And kind of continuing talking about Bob Hoskins, I'll finally talk about it. One of my favorite scenes in this movie, and it remains it rewatching the movie last night, is the laugh yourself to death scene towards the end of the movie, before we get to killing Christopher Lloyd. That moment when Bob Hoskins goes full tune and kind of does this whole song and dance moment. Because as a musical fan, I think it's kind of fantastic. And there's something about Hoskins' kind of dedication to that scene where he just kind of knowingly runs into all of these gags that it just kind of sells it so wonderfully.
Oh, absolutely. It's an extraordinary feat of physical slapstick humor. And more to the point, it's a great payoff to the little montage early in the film, which is, by the way, I love that they were able to communicate his entire backstory without any dialogue. That bit early when they're, you know, you pan around his desk and all the photos that basically walk you through his life in the last 15 years, and you see that there was that time when he and his brother were both on the force, when they were both clowns, essentially. I don't know how the hell they could be cops and be clowns at the same time, but apparently they pulled
they were
off.
Clown cops. They were
right,
clown cops.
Exactly, yeah.
They investigated clown crimes.
Well, if they're near Toontown, there must have been plenty of those. And I mean, you have the idea that he used to be a more fun-loving guy. So even what I love about that scene at the end that you cited, it's not just that he pulls it off physically. He still has that dark streak in him. So there is something, I think, intentionally kind of creepy about the way that he's singing that song that he's making up on the spot, and he's hitting himself. Like it's not like a wild and exuberant kind of Jim Carrey bit of slapstick. It's darker in that way. And I love that part. I love his performance in general. That scene is so great, though.
And I mean, you're right. I feel that if this was a Jim Carrey performance, like, he would have given it a bit too much, like, wackiness in the way he delivered it. There's something about seeing Hoskins, who we've seen for the whole movie, kind of be that serious Sam Spade kind of character. And he still kind of keeps most of that in that moment. Mm-hmm. And it makes it that much more intriguing for you, because you're kind of going, like, it's kind of breaking the wall where you're seeing Sam Spade, but you're also seeing the wacky, and it's weird to see it together, even though you understand the reasoning for why he's doing it.
Yeah, exactly. I agree.
So one of the things I kind of thought about dealing with this movie, because we talked about the blend of the animation I'm kind of curious as to how, since you'd mentioned this movie being one of those first movies you remember seeing in the theater, how is it that you kind of ended up going down this road of being deeply invested in the world of animation, and more specifically the world of Disney animation?
Well, I mean, I think part of what contributed to this, but not entirely, was, you know, when I grew up, I mean, the year after The Little Mermaid came out, and then you had the entire Disney Renaissance, so it was a very good time to be a kid growing up with animation, because, you know, a few years earlier, Disney had been struggling with animation. They didn't really have a lot to offer aside from stuff like The Fox and the Hound or The Black Cauldron, neither of which I'm a big fan of. And there also hadn't been a lot of competition for a long time in terms of features, whereas after stuff like The Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast came out, other studios started investing in animation, so that became something that was more prevalent. But then, as an adult, what happened was, I think the major, the flashpoint for me was that my wife and I went on our honeymoon to Walt Disney World, and that, I had not been to Disney World in a long time, and it was like going with fresh eyes, going as a grown-up kid again, and kind of appreciating that theme park, and then by appreciating the theme parks, I got back into rewatching a lot of classic Disney films. And then one day I basically told myself, I want to start a podcast, and I need to have a good hook for a podcast, because I'm just some random dude in the middle of Arizona. And if I want people to listen to a podcast, I need to have a good idea. And I kind of realized then that my rebirth of love of Disney movies would have been a perfect combination with a podcast. So,
I mean, it definitely is, and I think most, like, it's kind of what I realize happening in film criticism online these days, and I kind of use that term loosely, because personally, I never like to call myself a film critic, and I'm kind of weaning myself away from that category, but I find more and more the conversations, the more unique conversations, aren't coming from what's out this week in the theater, but going like, do you remember what happened 50 years ago in Hollywood, in movies, and just kind of going down that rabbit hole of rediscovering what was? So it makes me more and more interested in kind of thinking about the longevity of films today, where we just mentioned it. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is a big movie that kind of hit theaters this weekend gone by, which I haven't seen yet. But I'm kind of curious to consider, what will people still be talking about Dawn of the Planet of the Apes in 30 years?
Yeah, you know, I think that's definitely an interesting point. I think the advantage, by the way, to Dawn of the Planet of the Apes coming out now is that a lot of critics are going back to the original Planet of the Apes movies, which kind of speaks to your point that I mean, I think there is value, obviously, in reviewing the new films that are coming out. But I think it's too often in modern film culture that people focus so much more on the new, and they essentially forget films from the 50s, the 40s, the 30s, you know, as far back as the silent era. And there's a wealth of amazing cinema in every decade of the 20th century. And I think too many people just kind of focus on what's coming next instead of what came before. So I agree with you.
And I mean, I think more and more on the internet, we're kind of becoming hungry for this idea of getting to hear other people's experiences going through things we've already experienced. So kind of like you talking about your reintroduction into the world of classical Disney, where we are just like, I remember when I was 10 and I saw all of those movies. I want to hear what this guy feels like as he's going through it as an adult. There's people who spend their blogging lives, their criticism lives, just running through the Criterion Collection, where we just basically get to hear their lives going through the career of the Wes Andersons, of the Bogdanoviches, of the sure. of the Kiarostamis. And it just becomes us going like, I'm happy for this person, because I realize there was this point in time where it changed from me being angry at someone for not having seen something to me being jealous at that person for being able to see it for the very first time.
Sure. I think that's definitely that can definitely be a cool feeling, because, you know, there is a part of me that wishes I had seen this for the first time a different time, because, you know, on the one hand, I can look at it and say, well, seeing Who Framed Roger Rabbit at such a young age and loving it then allows me to revisit it and appreciate it anew every time I see it, because I like to think this is one of those movies that, even though I've seen it hundreds of times, probably, I still get something new out of it every time. But then the flip side is me thinking, but if I'd seen it for the first time now, I might have appreciated it entirely that one time instead of kind of having that piecemeal effect. But I mean, at the same, I don't know that I would want to give up my experience that I had, but I'd be, you know, it's always kind of a curious thing, like what, like how much more might I appreciate a certain film as an adult if it was the first time I saw it versus when I was a kid and knew very little about it.
Can you imagine just how trippy that experience would be seeing it for the first time today?
Yeah, I mean, I can try to imagine that, but I don't know if my imagination would equal the real thing. I mean, and that goes for, I think, a lot of Disney films. And there are sometimes when I revisit movies on the podcast that I haven't seen in decades where it feels like I'm watching it for the first time. And sometimes that can be a good thing. And sometimes that might not be a very good thing, because, you know, the minefield of doing Disney movies on a podcast is that, you know, you watch something when you're a kid and you love it to pieces, and then you watch it as an adult and you have to admit to yourself, boy, that kid version of me was a dummy, because he liked some stuff that was silly and wasn't nearly as, like, things that don't maybe hold up on, not so much on a repeat viewing so much as don't hold up when you're older, when you're more mature, when you have more knowledge about life. Maybe you, what you bring to a movie almost detracts from that experience.
I'm kind of curious. As someone who runs a podcast, which is kind of neat, it put itself in its own little niche, that being Disney, and while you still kind of manage to kind of deal with modern Disney movies as they're coming out, including all of their corporate subsidies, including Marvel, because I think I looked on your schedule and I saw you have Guardians of the Galaxy scheduled for discussions.
Sure do. Marvel is Disney now.
Marvel is Disney. You can now talk about Marvel. I'm curious.
We've been talking about it for about a year, actually. Yeah, we've been. I think the first one we did. Oh boy, we did Thor: The Dark World. That might have been the first Marvel movie we talked about. But I mean, Disney has officially owned Marvel's movies for at least a year or so. So yeah, they are up for grabs.
Right. I'm kind of curious, for someone who runs a podcast that's dealt with that finite level of what you can talk about, do you ever worry that you're going to run out of stuff to kind of focus on and talk about?
Well, here's a fun thing. I have created a calendar for the podcast, and I actually created it a long time ago, partly to give myself an order in terms of what movie I'm going to watch each week instead of just randomly choosing one from a hat, essentially. And I maintain it still. The calendar that I have, it's the one that is on Movie Mezzanine, only goes through the end of this year. The calendar that I have goes through the end of 2025. Because on the one hand, you think to yourself, there is a finite amount of movies that Disney has. And that's true. But at the same time, you know, you've alluded to it. They own Marvel. They own Lucasfilm now. They own Pixar. They owned for 17 years Miramax, which is why a couple weeks ago we started doing Miramax movies on the show. We did Pulp Fiction. And you know, that might seem like a stretch, but again, Disney owned Miramax, which means that all those movies were under the Disney umbrella for 17 years. They own Touchstone, which is why we can talk about Who Framed Roger Rabbit, because again, that's not technically from Walt Disney Pictures. I mean, I am not worried. I am not worried about running out of movies. And, you know, my co-host Gabe sometimes rolls his eyes. He happens to not be a huge fan of Pulp Fiction, so he was not 100% thrilled to be revisiting that film.
Oh, but you should have brought me on there to talk Pulp Fiction, and I would have had fun just jabbing him Fiction love.
We were lucky enough to have on the writer from Flavor Wire, Jason Bailey, who happened to write a book about Pulp Fiction last year, and he definitely gave Gabe a bit of the business for not being a huge fan. And, you know, again, I think that offers us this wealth of cinematic content, because there are, I think for the first 50 years or so of Disney's history, they really don't have that many movies. So they have a lot of live action films. But then after they started buying companies or having smaller subsidiaries like Touchstone or Hollywood, and they started making a lot more money and owning a lot more films, and that has expanded their reach greatly.
So are you mentioned it as the kind of thing that kind of pushed you to go back to Disney, being that you went to Disneyland,
Disney World.
I'm sorry. I always.
That's okay. So that's all right.
I have been there twice in my lifetime. I went there when I was, I believe, 3 years old. And I always tell my parents this because I remember I went there with my older brother, who's 3 years my elder, and my mother and my grandmother. And I tell them there are three things I remember about that trip. I remember going on the plane, because I remember when I was on the plane, like, we had, if I remember correctly, there were two rows of seats. There were the right side and the left side. And what happened was my grandmother and my mother split us, my older brother and I, apart. And what we did for the whole flight was we continually switched seats. I remember that. I remember taking a picture with Mickey. And I remember going to the beach and losing my teddy bear in the sea. Those are the only things I remember from that trip. And then I went again when I was about 15 years old, because at that time, my younger brother had just graduated from prep school, primary school. I don't know what you guys call it over that side. Before you reach middle school.
That would be elementary school.
Elementary. So our system is different. We have 6 grades of pre-high school, and then high school is like 7 years. It's like, it's weird. And my mother knew she couldn't handle my younger brother at the time by herself, so she dragged me along. And I was happy because I was a teenager, and I was like, I get to finally, for the first time in like a decade, spend a summer outside of my own country. And to be quite honest, it was a horrible experience for me. We went on the July the 4th weekend.
Oh, that's a bad idea.
And we were at Disney World the night of July the 4th, seeing all the fireworks. And I am not someone who is very afraid of crowds or afraid of people, or like, you know how mothers are with children. They're like, we should stay together. And I'm like, I'm a child. I'm a teen. I don't want to. It was the first time in my life where I'm like, mommy, you are holding my hand this entire time and we're not letting go as we're going through that crowd. And it was just a horrible experience generally for me going to Disney World. So I don't really associate Disney World, the park, with that many great things, because I lost my teddy bear and it was scary when I was 15.
Sure.
But I'm kind of curious, like, are you someone who kind of continues to visit Disney World? Like, is it something where you are invested in them as a theme park as much as you're invested in them as an animation and film studio?
I would say yes. I haven't been to Disney World since, I believe, May of 2012, but my wife and I have gone 3 times. We've gone on our honeymoon then 2 more times in between then and now, and we have traveled to Disneyland many times in that 5 or 6 year period. I mean, I think, had gone more frequently to the theme parks, not often, but a little more frequently than I had before our honeymoon. But I really fell in love with the theme parks after that trip. By now, I think I'm in a place of conditional love with the theme parks as I am with the studios, by which I mean I know that the theme parks can be amazing, that they can deliver great attractions and fireworks and other kinds of shows and experiences. And I know that the Disney Animation Unit, as well as Walt Disney as a whole, can make brilliant films. But I also know they're not perfect, and sometimes they make stupid mistakes that are difficult to deal with, even if you have to just kind of grin and bear it. I mean, I am still invested in the theme parks in terms of, like, my wife is expecting her first child now, and I am excited to bring our child to the theme parks when he's old enough to appreciate them. But, you know, I'm also aware that they're not perfect, you know?
It's kind of interesting thinking about this now that we've reached this point in this conversation where we started out with you talking about Who Framed Roger Rabbit as your first cinematic memory when you were about three. And I just realized one of my first memories was being three going to Disney World.
Well, I mean, yeah, Disney is for a lot of people, especially around our age, I think, that formative experience that's hard not to remember something associated with Disney when you're a little kid. They get their hooks in you quick.
Yeah, they do. And I will always remember Winnie the Pooh and cry the moment someone kind of shared this little interpretation in that this is about Winnie the Pooh is about a child with 20 different disorders and every character represents that disorder. And I'm like, screw you, goddammit, that works in my dark brain of being an adult and thinking everything is cynical.
I don't know that I would say Christopher Robin has disorders so much as just various personality traits, but otherwise I do agree with that.
No, I'm not giving any more credence to that than me thinking it's a happy little show that children will love. But interpretations are that, and they just kind of seek into your mind and give you very new flavors to look at films and filters was the word I was thinking of. Filters to look at these pieces of art as. Because, I mean, that's what I find most interesting when you talk about things that a lot of people will dismiss as childish or not worth the mental credence that we will give some of these films, where we will look at Winnie the Pooh and be like, yeah, it's just a children's show about a bear and they're having adventures. But then it's as important to think about that as much as we think about Russian literature. Because the truth of the matter is that it's an adult making these things. And he can place so many interesting elements into all of these stuff that create interesting conversations and interesting thoughts about life and what's going on with him. There's no limit to how far you can take an interpretation. Because it's what gives the actual art value.
I would definitely agree with that, and I think that is a stigma that is always a challenge to fight with, this idea that Disney is just for kids and that's it. It's certainly a phase I went through when I was in my teenage years, which is kind of why I fell out of caring as much about Disney specifically. I was still a big fan of Pixar, but I think it is a stigma that is worth fighting against. Sometimes the problem is that Disney kind of buys into that idea. Like, I feel like sometimes, not with anything we've mentioned here, but there are sometimes where they make something that feels like, well, it's for kids. We don't need to think about it too much. Even if they're adults making it, it's like they're not really going to try that hard because who cares? It's for kids. Just put it in front of a kid for 90 minutes and they're fine, you know?
Flashlights.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it's frustrating because it's one thing for a random person to feel that way, but when you kind of get the idea that Disney or people working at Disney feel, some people, not everybody who works at Disney, I think, does this, but there are some where it feels like they just don't care, which they should, especially because, you know, as I said, these are among the most formative, like these are the beginnings almost of your cultural awareness and your cultural diet almost. Is Disney. So it is important to reflect on that when you're an adult to kind of figure out the source of your interest in culture. If it happens to be that you love Disney, to kind of dig to the source of that, or if you hate Disney, to figure out why, because it can be, I think, very enlightening.
Yeah. I think I had a thought, but I think I've lost it. You ever have those moments? I hate to think of myself as old having these moments because I know I'm not.
I have those moments far too often.
I guess that's a good enough spot for us to stop at, and I want to thank you so much for talking with me, Josh.
Thank you for having me on the show. It was a real pleasure.
Guys, I'm sorry I revealed so much about my childhood. Yes, I don't know where my teddy bear is. And if you have found him, please mail him to Jamaica so I can get him back, because I miss him. Thank you so much for listening. As always, this is the Movies You Love podcast. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at GManReviews. Listen to the podcast you're listening to right now, as if you already didn't know where to find it, over at GManReviews.com, through iTunes and or Stitcher, and go and rate and review the show. And go and say hi to Josh on Twitter. He's at Mousterpiece. Go tell him, hey, say him you listen to this, because, guys, I want to once again say thank you, Josh, for coming on and joining me. But that's about it for the show this week. Good day, good night, good luck. I don't know how that sentence goes, but let's just call this the end. Yeah. When you arouse the need in me, my heart says yes indeed in me. Proceed with what you're leading me to. 'Cause it's such an ancient pitch, and it's one that I never switch. 'Cause there's no nicer witch than